Connor, I watched Bake Off yesterday. It was very good.
I
don't have to talk about Bake Off, though.
Do not spoil Bake Off for me because I have not watched it yet. But I do want to address some listener feedback I got about last week's episode, now that you mentioned Bake Off. Mm-hmm. It is not, quote, gay shit, end quote, for us to talk about Bake Off on this podcast.
Did I say that or did you say that?
No, somebody messaged me and said, they quoted Bread Week. I never want to hear you say gay shit like that again. It's like, hey, man.
Well, that's too fucking bad because we like Bread Week and we like Bake Off, so it's going to stay gay.
I had no idea S. Craig Zoller listened to the podcast, but sounds like he's back.
Very good. As you can hear, our friend Nate Smith is back
Nate.
To talk about something that's not Mormon. I don't think there's a single Mormon connection.
Not an ounce of Mormonism in this movie.
No. Well, Alec, I mean, first off, hey, Propagandos, it is Saturday, October 19th at 10:10 a.m. Like Alec said, we're recording with Nate Smith again. Alec, you really wanted to review this movie. You mentioned it last week. So what you're driving this week. So why don't you say what we're doing?
I mean, so everybody that's listened to last week's episode knows that when I saw Don Johnson in Rebel Ridge, I said, hey, that's the guy from that shitty movie that I like. That's the guy from Dragged Across Concrete, right? Which is S. Craig Zoller's third feature film. He's best known for Bone Tomahawk and is like, I guess like a B-movie guy. His stuff like comes out in theaters. Bone Tomahawk was very well received and is like very famous, especially amongst like horror movie fans. A weird kind of like body horror western, like it has like Lovecraftian elements, and then a lot of other weird stuff, and he ends up making two more movies, Brawl and Cell Block 99 and this Dragged Across Concrete. And when I saw Don Johnson in Rebel Ridge, and he's phenomenal, I thought, that's the guy from Dragged Across Concrete. He's like deputy lieutenant or something in this, in like a very short scene. One of the funniest scenes, I think, in the film, although the film is very, very funny. And it made me want to watch it. And like Rebel Ridge has, I think, such like is so well written, and like all the characters are well fleshed out and like understandable. None of them are, I mean, like I said, right? I think one or two of them are like detestably evil, right? But at the very least, like you can understand them, right? They're not like caricatures, and that's good writing. And then just Don Johnson being in this other movie where I think everyone in it is like a gross stereotype. Maybe ironically, except for the person who kind of wins at the end. Right. And even he's been like, he's like kind of stereotyped too. But it's like kind of the opposite, right? Like everybody's written into these weird like character corners. And I wanted to watch it.
I will say on this, you call this a shitty movie to start off with. I kind of think this is probably, when we look back, going to be remembered as one of the 10 best movies of 2019. Like, it's going to be one of the ones that's just remembered. And it, specifically because it comes out the year before the George Floyd, it has important artistic context into where conservatism was before the rupture that was COVID and everything.
Oh, fascinating.
That is a very good point.
I didn't think about it in terms of the timeline of, like, American politics. Because it's let's be frank, Zoller has a lot of weird racial hangups. This is a director and writer and producer of these three films. And if you've seen Bone Tomahawk and if you've seen this, you know that like Craig Zoller has been described, and I think fairly accurately, as like a far right artist politically, right? Some people would just say he's an American fascist, right? And as such, he talks about race pretty openly in ways that are can make the audience uncomfortable, mm-hmm. right? Or very comfortable, depending on who you are,
right?
I don't know necessarily. So about halfway through the movie, I started having this thought about like, well, why didn't this movie make money, right? Because so for the point of reference, the budget for this movie was $15 million. It made $600,000 at the box office. And then I got to the Jennifer Carpenter sequence, which is we introduce a new character who is a a recent mother who is coming back for her first day after maternity leave, who does not want to go, whose husband has to push her out the door, and then gets crosswise with the evil bad guys immediately at her new job and gets her head blown off. And I was like, oh, this is why Red America did not embrace this movie.
There was just so much buildup for her backstory for her to just be eliminated within like 8 minutes.
You know what?
Classic Zoller. Classic.
I think I like that. What I like about that, it is disturbing. One, and also my wife decided to like start watching along for that, just that sequence.
Oh no.
Which is the worst, which is one of the most brutal things committed to film. But I think one of the things that this movie does well, and I think it's a point that Zoller is making. I don't know if this is what qualifies as like the fascism of it but that there are every person in this movie has like a backstory and is going a direction. And none of that matters when you get opposite the intractable evil at the center of the movie, which is these three masked men, basically, who you never really get a good look at.
The gimpy bandits, as Alec called them.
Yeah. That's nice. And this is like, again, right? This is like classic Zoller. When you look at his other films and you look at the themes of those films, one of them is that most of the people that inhabit the worlds that he shows you are literally bystanders so that he can show you that the evil guy is evil, mm-hmm. right? And they have no real ability to save themselves. They have no like moral weight except for their death, right? And so in particular, right, like Zoller uses women very frequently as these like moral props, right? So he introduces them. He says, "This is a very nice lady, by the way, kind of weak-willed because she has to get pushed out the door." Like in a film of bizarre sequences from a director and writer who only makes bizarre sequences, this stands out as like one of the weirdest ones in the film, because like every time I rewatch it, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot that like he has to like kick her out and she's like having a little mini breakdown and then she gets brutally murdered. Like, this is classic Zoller, right?
I think in a weird way this could be read, and you know what, like, to be honest here, just to clear like my thoughts, Craig Zoller comes to filmmaking from novel writing, which I think is largely considered to be the art form in which conservatives thrive the most, right? Like with your like, you know, new journalism and all that. But I think he's very intentional in what he's doing here. I think, one, she delivers that monologue about how pointless it is to work at a bank, right? And the fact that it is her husband, she makes more, she's the breadwinner. So the husband pushes her out the door. I think that's him making a comment on the way that society has sort of like changed,
like stripped motherhood
and changed gender roles to no real benefit, mm-hmm. like for no altruism, but just for its own benefit. And that ultimately the reason she dies is because someone in her office decides to value the money more than the lives and force her into that situation. I think a part of it is this is a movie about how much your job sucks. If your job is a criminal or a cop, how you are only truly free when you are either let out of prison or put out to pasture on police brutality charges or maternity leave. And that returning to that world is the epitome of folly. I think that
HR is good because it can fire you and then you can self-actualize outside of the workplace.
Yes. You would be better. I think I truly believe if S. Craig Zoller is one of those guys who's like, if you could just like live up in the woods, like that would be a more ethical life for you. There is nothing about the city of Bulwark that he sees as redeemable.
Yeah. I'll walk us through a mini plot synopsis because full disclosure for those listening at home, I messaged Nate and Alec about an hour into this movie. I said, this movie sucks shit. And literally, as soon as I hit send, it ramped the fuck up. Like, it got...
Also, classic Zoller.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have not seen any Zoller films. I've been meaning to watch Bone Tomahawk. Something tells me I'm not going to watch Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, but I'll probably get around to Brawl and Cell Block 99 as well. I do have interest in reading his book, A Congregation of Jackals, which is a mm-hmm. Western that got an award, according to his Wikipedia page. So I like Westerns. I'll probably read that. But before I get into the plot synopsis, or should I wait until after to talk about my issues with the dialogue? I'll get into the plot synopsis. So the movie opens up with the movie opens up with what is his name?
Henry Johns.
A man named Henry Johns. He is released from prison. He's sleeping with a childhood crush of his. And then he goes back home. He just got out of prison. He checks in on his mom. His mom is now a prostitute. And he's angry that she's a prostitute who's addicted to heroin. Decides to go see his brother, his son, his little buddy Ethan, who is a crippled kid playing video games. And it's very, I have to say that Henry Johns is a black man. Everyone's race is very important in this movie, as Zoller makes the thing to point out. Then it cuts to 3 weeks later. We see Mel Gibson. He's on the balcony of a window, and he's stopping Latino criminal number one, we'll call him. I don't remember his name, but it is in this moment that you get to see that Mel Gibson and his partner, Vince Vaughn, are sarcastic, wisecracking, and crooked above all else.
Are they crooked?
They're not, at this moment, they are not revealed to be crooked.
They're not stealing the money.
But they are.
But they are functionally for the city. And I think this is important for the overall standard. What they are doing is they are stick up men. They are robbing a drug dealer at the start of the money because they're going to, they get that. The most important thing is not arresting the drug dealer. It's getting that duffel bag of the stuff. So they are stick up men for the state. Basically.
Yeah.
They have orchestrated a plot to just as any like robber would to, you know, have someone knock at the door, drive the drug dealer to go out to the fire escape. That's where they're waiting for him. Subdue him, go in there, you know, strong arm the girlfriend into telling like what they are attempting to do for the rest of the movie is just their job as freelancers. Basically, they want to take the money. Like your last episode was about civil asset forfeiture. That's what American policing is about, right? Breonna Taylor is killed because they think they're going to find a duffel bag full of money in there. That was the only reason they were going in there. It is, I think, one of the reasons why I don't think this can be like seen as straight police apologia is what they're doing is not really keeping people safe. Right. They're engaged in violent thrill seeking, but gain seeking behavior.
Like thuggery, basically. Yeah. I mean, like, but it comes in direct contradiction. And again, right, like I will underline, I do not know if Craig as Zoller is smart enough to understand that this is what he's portraying or not. I'm not joking, right? Like I'm not joking when I say that I thought that Bone Tomahawk was satire until I watched some of his future movies. I don't know if he understands this because it directly contradicts what they repeatedly tell themselves, right? Like, we are good guys. We keep drugs off the street. When in fact, they can't even leave the apartment, right? The apartment, like, theoretically, they could come back to at some later point, right? It's going to be a crime scene without finding and obtaining this bag of money.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I think that's the. I'm going to give Craig Zoller this. I'll see. I'll watch Bone Tomahawk and think if I think he's an idiot that's kind of like Forrest Gumping his way through through great America. He's basically Forrest Gumping his way through Sam Peckinpah's career. But like the.
Yeah, basically.
I think that what you're setting up is I think that the character played by Tori Kittles, Henry Johns, and his cousin are meant to be a foil or a mirror in the same way that like Laertes is a foil of Hamlet to the cops. They're cops, there's robbers, they're on the same side. They're both released from their structures. One is released from prison, one is released, or the other two are suspended. And they're going in for the job to change their families, specifically like to get their young teenage relatives in a safer situation, taking care of the next generation. That is where
they're protective father figures, right? Yep. Like doing their duty to the family, yep. Right? In their own way.
Yes.
So to your point, Nate, they're not crooked, but they do commit, I guess for lack of a better term, an act of police brutality by, Alec and I were discussing this, by whose standard? Like,
in real life, these guys would not even be suspended.
It's hilarious that the film... Yeah, they basically like step on a guy's neck. By the way, this is pre-BLM, yeah, right? This is pre. So like they arrest a guy on like a staircase or something, and as part of subduing him, of like holding him on the ground while they, I guess, search the apartment, questionably legally, I don't know, right? Mel Gibson, is it Mel Gibson or Vince Vaughn? No, Vince Vaughn, right? Like puts his literal boot on the back of the man's neck, and a neighbor right in this apartment complex like takes a video, and it goes viral, right? And therefore
it's about to go viral. So then sure. Don yeah. Johnson, the chief of police, is like, can't do that anymore, fellas. I'm going to have to suspend you for 6 weeks with no pay, when realistically we know they'd get administrative duty for 2 weeks with pay.
Yeah.
If anything. Got,
yeah, if
also,
anything.
We know that police departments are always trying to get ahead of these things and doing the punishment before they have to. That's definitely something they're very famous for doing.
And also, I mean, there's an enormous breadth of actual violence that you can do to suspects, to people that you are, you know, holding if they are resisting, that does not faze police departments at all.
Yeah.
The fact that the guy is a drug dealer alone, I think, means that this would never make the news, because the there are people who will quibble about George Floyd, who died, which this guy does not die, because he tried to, because he forfeited, because he was using drugs, basically. They'll be like, well, he had, like, this guy's a drug kingpin, right? Like, there's no, nobody cares if you're, when these guys are bringing in guilty people, police brutality really only comes up when it is treated towards people who are turned to be innocent, or their degree of innocence. This guy's not innocent. These guys would never be. But also, this isn't a real world. It's in Bulwark City, right? There's a yes, point. Right. Yes. I don't think it's, I think that there is an element there where it, like, this is like Gotham, right? This is, if you abstract it just enough away to understand that this is a world like 2019, but perhaps more woke, right? Like maybe this is where we were headed before COVID, that eventually this would have gotten to be the case where like police officers were held to this level of account. But yeah, I mean, obviously it's not.
We could do some analysis, by the way, on like the word bulwark and its use here, but I think it's fairly obvious, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is, you know, this is the dike that holds back, right? Like all of the
thin blue line. Yeah.
Yeah. The thin blue line, or like the thing that, I mean, especially with like European, the far right in Europe, I feel this all the time, right? That like, this is what the Hungarians say about themselves, right? That like, we are the wall that hold back the hordes or something like that, right? We are the shield wall or something, right? Like, I don't know.
Well, which is interesting, because I don't think necessarily that this movie has a clear idea of what they are a bulwark against, because your black criminals are very sympathetic. Their white overlords are the most evil people. They're like basically, I would say the sequences that you see around this time in the chronology, where you see, I think it's Black Govs and Grey Govs is what they're called. These two masked characters go in, and one rob a liquor store and kill two people, and one just...
Wait, hold on. We haven't quite gotten there yet.
But
because we're fast forward.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I'll jump back to my thoughts on the Gloved Brothers in a second.
But. So once Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson are, which is Ridgman and Lorisetti, once they are suspended... we get to see a little bit of their lives. Vince Vaughn, Lorisetti, is dating someone and wants to propose. And Mel Gibson has a wife with MS and a daughter who keeps getting assaulted by teens throwing soda in her face. and she cries every time it happens. And
should we
go ahead.
Sorry. Should we discuss the... Because I think they talked to John Johnson before any of that happened.
Let's talk about Sonny Crockett coming in. I love that you call it like you're like Don Johnson's like that guy from this movie, and not like, oh, is that beloved TV star Don Johnson in Miami Vice and now Bridges?
Yeah, I do. Well, he's a lot older, right? When you go watch that stuff from like the 80s, right? Like he's a lot older now. And I'm like,
do you know, is he right wing in real life? Because he's
I don't think he is. I think he's just an actor who's working and he like kind of stays out of politics.
So he's had a couple
ever
parts
talked about politics
recently One is in the show The Watchmen that on HBO, where he kind of, you know, spoiler alert for a show that came out the same year as this, actually, where he's a police chief who's secretly a racist. And also he's in Knives Out this that same year in 2019, where he's playing sort of like a kind of Trumpy faux, you know, Republican. He wears that role well on that. Like he probably like. If he wanted to, I mean, this is probably, if he wanted to be like a right-wing dictator, Don Johnson definitely has the starter kit to make it happen. He's handsome enough, he's got the face. But he's approachable enough.
I would imagine he's like a libertarian because he was best friends with Hunter S. Thompson.
Ooh. Or, I mean, I could easily see him, Connor, being one of those like Hollywood Republicans, right? Where it's like, this is a meaningless word, right?
Yeah. Well, this stars two Hollywood Republicans in Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson.
Very openly.
Yes. Although Mel Gibson's very weird because he does not talk about his politics as much as you would. A lot of the, again, similar to Craig Zahler, a lot of the politics is us trying to like read the tea leaves. On what is actually
that
there.
Time he got drunk and said that all the wars are blamed on the Jews.
Yes. Well, but that's one time, and that was 18 years ago.
And that's just something that Catholics say, Connor. That's not really.
Well, I think that's funny because not to get too far from the plot, I remember the morning that he got arrested when that story broke because I was going for football practice. It was like the start of I think it was in August. And so I was listening to the radio and that's when that story broke. I think the big thing is that Mel Gibson, there had been whispers and whispers about the anti-Semitism, the far right beliefs, the conspiratorialism. There wasn't a lot concrete there. People knew that his dad was really far right and people knew that he had a really high opinion of his father. But the thing about that arrest was that suddenly removed the benefit of the doubt that he had been benefiting from for 20 years. And that's the kind of the moment that the dam breaks and everyone just has to admit like, okay, there's kind of something dark going on there.
But that's kind of how it always happens, isn't it?
I mean, Vince Vaughn has an entirely different, like he slow launched himself as a libertarian, basically.
A timeline of racist allegations.
When you heard the story, when the news broke, did your coach send everybody home?
We were just
you didn't have to go to practice.
Everybody hung their heads.
I will say
it's
this.
A sad day, boys.
I was really distraught because I was thinking this through. So I was born in 90. I remember 95 when every family in the ward in the neighborhood was getting Braveheart on VHS. And I remember, must have known enough that I knew it was kind of silly that like Mel Gibson like had long hair like that. Like I knew that was. So I'm willing to bet that Mel Gibson is one of the first 1,000 names that I learned in a human life.
Oh, interesting.
Like he was very present there.
Yeah. In my our VHS collection, it would be like The Patriot, right? That would be the, like the granddad movie, right? The dad movie that was on everybody's shelf.
A movie that also is hints it. A movie that actually would be a very interesting pairing with this in terms of Mel Gibson plays a character with questionable racial politics. And this is like one of the things that's most interesting about Mel Gibson. When you actually see the fury that's like behind the eyes slip, that is something. And that happens in The Patriot when he hacks that guy to death at the very start of it.
And like the absurd levels of like embellishment that The Patriot engages in is not that far from like Zahler, right?
No.
It really is not.
No, it's total apologia.
Okay, so the Don Johnson scene where everyone gets suspended. So Don Johnson explains like, hey, somebody took a video of y'all. You cannot do this. So now you got like 6 weeks with pay. He's basically kind of lamenting that like things aren't what they used to be anymore. So you can't like just step on someone's neck. So he's not exactly like, hey, y'all fucked up. He's just like, everyone's got a fucking smartphone these days. So you got to be careful. And then he gets some one-on-one time with Mel Gibson where it's revealed that like they used to be partners. And Don Johnson changed with the times and knew how to politic, and that's why he's the chief, and Mel Gibson refuses to do so, and that's why he's poor and has a wife who's sick and a daughter who gets bullied.
Not only has refused to do so, has moved in the opposite direction. Because Don Johnson says, I saw that, and you didn't used to be that violent.
He's becoming more
violent. I think that is actually a key part of that character. he is disintegrating into the violence.
Yeah. So he's definitely not staying. He says, like, I'd refuse to change with the politics. So do we think that that's like the Overton window is shifting and that's why he seems more and more extreme? Or do we think that he's like actually just like getting worse and worse and worse and worse?
I think both can be true. Yeah. I mean, like, I think this scene exists so that we can actually, realistically, we can look down on Don Johnson, because Mel Gibson is kind of like walks out with that kind of smugness, right? That like, I didn't change, the world did. And, you know, I think I know who this film is targeted at. And I think that's a very, very resonant message, right? That like, that in a way, it is it's a denigration of Don Johnson acquiescing to a changing world. Right. And that the kind of punishment that all of the characters endure in the film, but especially Mel Gibson, of poverty, of a lack of success, is a fundamental injustice. Right. He says, what is it? My record, my numbers are good. Right. Like, I make the arrests. I catch the bad guys. And yet I am not rewarded. And you, who know how to politic, who acknowledge, right, this, like, the failures of the system and how everything's, like, fucking woke, which, like, by the way, like, we have to talk about that in a second. That character has obviously been rewarded and admits it openly.
And I think that's probably largely true of how police departments work to an extent, right? Like, the good cops are not getting rewarded if we accept Ridgman's premise that he is a good cop. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to talk about the wokeness aspect of the...
It's one of my favorite parts of the film.
Politics, like always.
Like cell phones, just as annoying. Politics are everywhere. Being branded a racist and today's public forum is like being accused of communism in the 50s. Whether it's a possibly offensive remark made in a private phone call or the indelicate treatment of a minority who sells drugs to children, the entertainment industry, formerly known as the news, needs villains.
There's certainly nothing hypocritical about the media handling every perceived intolerance with complete and utter intolerance.
It's bullshit. But it's reality.
I'm not racist. Every Martin Luther King Day, I order a cup of duck roast.
So Connor, if we could stay on this for just a second.
Yeah.
There's like probably a 60-second segment where I guess it just sounds like, at first, I wondered if Mel Gibson had a hand in writing this, because some of it feels like it's literally about Mel Gibson. But it's like Craig Zahler, I feel like, using the characters to speak directly to the audience. It's very, very funny.
You know what? This is actually something I looked this up, because also Brett Ridgman is like what Mel Gibson would be named in a Law & Order episode that was about the Mel Gibson scandal. The movie star would be named Brett Ridgman. As like,
that's very funny.
It's that close. Supposedly, yep. Zahler and Quebec, Tori Kittle's backed this up in the interview. I said, did not change a word of dialogue. But I think what he did is, I think he wrote this dialogue because this scene had an audience of one, and it's Mel Gibson and his agent getting them to do this movie. Like, because this is the movie that this is the movie that is the most about Mel Gibson that any Mel Gibson movie has ever been.
I'm sorry.
And it kind of weirdly, like, Connor knows I've been going through a huge thing where it's like, how do you approach someone like Mel Gibson? Because so here's the thing. We talked about the two right-wing actors. Vince Vaughn has what I would say is probably the modal politics of a 6'5" white man from Chicago, Illinois, born in 1973 or whatever, right? They're all sort of right-wing, libertarian, you know, like whatever.
It's certainly not surprising. It's not like shocking. Right?
Mel Gibson has if Mel Gibson believes what his father believed. So like, let's just say let's take what he has said and just what Hutton Gibson is known to believe. He is in a line of esoteric fascism that has like operated in the dark of American elite circles for years and years and years and years and years. He is much closer to fascism than like Donald Trump. Who he's never really embraced, by the way. That is like one thing that's, there's like a video of him like saluting him at UFC at something like in 2021. But there is like, he did not, is not endorsed him. Like that's the other thing that's weird about Mel Gibson is he's never done, he's never run back to the right wing for anti-cancel protection in the way that like.
He's really kind of embraced it.
Yeah.
Right. And he's for the most part, he still stars and stuff. He's still around. Right. But he has just gone away. Right. He said, I'm taking my toys and I'm going home. And he meant it. Right. And he doesn't, you don't hear him bitching and whining, right, or trying to reinvigorate his image and participate. It's not that, you know, I actually do strangely have a kind of respect for that, but critically he's not, he's rejected the machine, right, and is not taking a role in that kind of, in the machine politics of image and culture war that one could easily take as somebody who's been kind of excised from the herd.
Uh-huh. And who once was untouchable. Was once the biggest star in Hollywood. So I that is the thing where I like, I do, and I have a, like a bizarre respect for his filmmaking and his, and the choice in films that he makes and his acting. Absolutely. But it's really hard to square that circle with what we've heard him one, what we have heard that he said to a Jewish police officer in 2006 and what we all heard him say to his girlfriend in 2010. Those two things are really hard to square in the same way that like Ridgman is revealed to have had, I think they said in like 2004 and two, like they say the years, but Ridgman has a record where he's been like charged for, like he's had these moments of disgrace that come to light as well. What's interesting is I think Mel Gibson probably does see himself as a good person.
I'm sure he does.
Right.
Sure he does.
So it's gotta be interesting to hear everybody tell you you're not. Right. I mean, that's functionally the I don't know if you're football fans, but that's functionally the story of the quarterback of the Cleveland Browns right now, of a guy who's been the hero his entire life. Suddenly a bunch of stuff comes out that he's actually kind of like a monster. And now he can't play football anymore. You know, like now he sucks. So
Who is this?
Deshaun Watson. We don't need to get too sidetracked into that. But I think
I know. I mean, I'm from Houston, so I know who he is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you should be grateful because he's that trade. Anyway, we're not here to talk about football. We're here to talk about football's greatest actor, which is Mel Gibson, who was somehow never in a football movie.
He should have been like the perennial coach, right? In this age, right? The kind of gray-haired guy on the sidelines. You don't think so?
Well, I was going to say, Braveheart is kind of a football movie. Like it is like they're running at each other from the lines. It has like that feel and it totally follows like football movie logic, whichever side wants it more and is like more pure of heart. That's how you win that battle. It's not stratagem. It's that. I was going to say, I think it's interesting that his daughter getting harassed, right? Which is actually kind of a tense scene because you don't know what he's going to do. And you have seen, you know, like where he's like following her. Obviously, that's like a very unpleasant, like bullying thing that happens. I think it's interesting that it's not more black and white. Like it is kind of mild. It is like well, you survived.
It's pretty black and white.
It is black and white in that sense. Yeah.
We're talking about. I think almost directly after the hand in your badge, you're on suspension scene with Don Johnson. We see a young white girl walking in the streets of Bulwark or Chicago or Baltimore or wherever.
Newark.
Right. It's Bulwark. Is where we're this fictional town. And then a young black guy on a bike, or I guess maybe a teenager even, right, on a bike, and then like runs past a huddle of guys like smoking a cigarette, like kind of hanging out in an alley, and they're like, yeah, man, do it. And he like rides his bike over to this girl and like empties a soda on her for no reason, right? Yeah. And then there's no follow-up. There's no like, get out of here, stay out of our neighborhood. It's just cruelty for cruelty's sake, right?
Which, I'm gonna argue that's more often what teenagers do than stay out of our hood. It's like I'm gonna go. And here's the thing: is white teenagers do that too. 15-year-old boys are the most nihilistically look who commits most of the violence and cruelty in our society. It's like boys from the ages of like 16 to 21, right? So the fact that it's not, they don't sexually harass her. They don't call her whitey or honky or anything. They do like. So it is like one of those things where like Mel Gibson throughout the movie is like, my daughter has been assaulted five times. It's like, well, if you're counting getting soda thrown on her as assault, what were those other four times? Like how, yeah, you know, but also I wouldn't want my kid to have to go through that 5 times.
The thing that's shocking is that it takes on, as soon as she like gets home and they start discussing what happens, it takes on this incredibly like racial.
Yes, it does. As
perspective.
By the way, right? It always does in real life.
Yeah.
Go ahead and get robbed as I have been. And when you tell people that, the second thing they always want to know is, so like what race was the guy? That's just an ass.
It's not good.
People start having, because it creates that like that meta narrative where like it's us versus them. But Zoller is showing you the other side of the equation too. He's showing you the black family that doesn't have anything, the depravity of it.
He will, but not those.
Not people, those people.
Right?
Yeah,
like that group of youths. Interestingly, you would think, right, that like in a Crash and like a kind of a cheesy liberal movie, that group would come back and have some element in the plot, good or bad.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
That would elucidate some ideology, right, that this person has, that the writer has. But they don't. They just exist to bully this white girl, and then kind of the white girl in return only exists to get bullied.
Yes.
And like this to me is like this aspect of this Zoller-esque kind of world building, right? Where there literally are bad people and good people, and most of the good people aren't even good people. They're just like they're just sheep. They're just like these actors that are acted upon by either bad or good people, right?
Zoller lacks the simplicity of American conservatism. That it is not there are good people and there's bad people. We need the police to keep the good people from the bad people. There are no good people, but there are very bad people. And the police have to protect all of us sinners from the very bad people, which I think is why people tend to go like, that sounds a little fascist, right? Like that's like that almost they're sort of treated, liberalism in this movie is treated as naivete.
It sounds very fashy. It'd be the odd thing is, if you've seen like Soviet film, this is not far from like a lot of the messages of Soviet film. And you know, at least if you trust, right, like some kind of political binary, those people are not fascists, right? Like this matches, by the way, a tremendous amount of Chinese filmmaking. And like, you know, say what you will, but like, it is the
it's the
Communist Party of China, right?
So it's authoritarian. Like, I think is the
yes.
is the lock there. I think the idea also that like when Mel Gibson's wife, who's played by Laurie Holden from Walking Dead, is like, I'm as liberal as an ex-cop could be. I love that. but also that's...
You don't say.
Truly you are.
yeah. That I mean, truly you are too. That's what... Always what someone says before they're about to say something extremely fucked up.
Oh, yeah.
I'm as bleeding heart as can be, but we need camps. You know, like that's...
You know me. I'm not racist.
Yeah.
Beep.
but I think it is interesting. Like, Mel Gibson's goal in this movie is to get money to move his family, to engage in white flight.
To do white flight.
Yeah, to move his family away, out of proximity from black people. But you're also like kind of like, well... You know, it's not. It doesn't seem like a totally unhonorable goal.
Bad neighborhoods exist.
Yeah, like you want to.
Poor neighborhoods exist.
And Henry, that's what he wants to do with his brother. Mm-hmm. It is his brother, by the way, Connor. It's not his son.
Gotcha. I don't think it was his son. It definitely. He would have been more excited to see his dad.
Yeah.
He's like age ambiguous, kind of in this.
Yes, as is his cousin, who is played by Michael J. White. Who is probably most known to audiences for getting killed by Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight as the black gangster that's like, that's enough of the clown.
Yes. The pencil trick.
Yes.
Guy.
Yes. Yes. So he, because they both like at times in this movie, they seem like they're like 40 in their 40s, which I think the actors actually are. And, and sometimes they feel like they're like in their 20s, like they're just like kids. Which is actually just an interesting thing of, you know, that the ages of it also don't really match up. Where like Vince Vaughn's character is supposed to be much younger than Vince Vaughn is, I think. Doesn't have a family. Just
looks like haggard, right? Both of them do.
All right. So it is revealed that Mel Gibson has bullied daughter and sick wife. And at that point, he, you know, concurrently with this, we are seeing a masked man commit murder with a large gun. Alec, what gun is this?
Wanton violence.
Wanton violence? Is that one of the restaurants that's in this town?
Yes. It's S. Craig Zahler's restaurant.
Yeah.
So Connor, I want to say that the first time we see what I'm going to refer to as the gimp murderers,
right?
The gimp robbers, because like the suit is crazy.
Yeah, they have gimp masks on. It's very.
Could we use that as the episode art, or do we
the gimp bandits
with the broken fingers?
No! Oof! Oof!
So, no, we can't. So, we can't post that.
I think we're introduced to this guy when a scene opens up randomly, and there's a guy watching. There's like a
this is good filmmaking
like in a liquor store. Yeah, yeah. There's a liquor store attendant smoking a cigarette inside, which I guess you can do somewhere. I don't know where.
Only in
and
Bulwark,
he's watching the news,
baby.
And Mel Gibson's on the TV. And then the door to the convenience store, whatever, opens, and this guy in this fucking all-black gimp suit with, like, welding goggles, like think of, like, Thief, if you've seen that, walks in with, like, a submachine gun and is like, you have 5 seconds to give me all your fucking money. And then he, like, starts counting down. By the way, there's so many funny things about this. So he does the thing that you do in movies, where you walk into the convenience store and you flip the open sign to closed, right? But then he doesn't lock the door. So like halfway through, this guy like pulling all the money out of the drawer or whatever, right? Like some random guy walks in and he's like, "Hey man, I need like a pack of," and then he's like, "Oh no!" And he just gets blown away right there. He just like turns around and like shoots this guy. So there's a guy dying on the floor. Yeah, go ahead.
The robber just proceeds to like shoot up all the booze and chips in the store. It's just like, fuck it, whatever.
Reminded me of Zodiac, of Fincher's,
yes,
Zodiac,
exactly. Yeah.
Which is interesting because that's obviously like a real guy, like that's a real thing that happened. But yeah, like the joy of, there's something joyful to his violence for him.
Yeah,
it's like immensely like evil and cruel.
Yes,
right. And then there's just so many funny like little aspects to it. Again, right? Like I'm on the spectrum when it comes to guns, right? So like any gun guy will immediately recognize that the firearm he's using is a very, very expensive and rare one, right? Like it's an MP7, a real MP7, which there is not a civilian version of, because there is not a semi-automatic version of. Maybe until they might be coming out with one like this year, but at this time it does not exist. This is like an H&K MP7. It's like a proprietary, like, I don't know if just like special ops submachine gun use it. It's got like a proprietary cartridge that's supposed to be like armor piercing and stuff. There is no fucking possible way anybody would use this gun for like robbing a convenience store. It's insane, right? But it's so fun, right? Like in a very like Michael Mann-esque way. And right, I think Zahler is like cribs from Michael Mann a lot.
If you have it, why not use it? I don't know. I'm not a gun
because
guy.
Because you wouldn't have it. Like the trouble that one would go through to obtain like an MP7, like a fully automatic, and by the way, like a suppressed, like a very, very fancy armor piercing submachine gun is wild. It's just like, it's nonsensical.
But,
right?
but if we concede that he has it, because he's an international criminal.
Yeah, I mean,
is there like a tactical reason why that would not be a good gun to use in a robbery or like?
Well, one, right? Like he's not, it's a submachine gun. And he's got it on full auto because he just blasts this fucking place. So he's leaving shell casings everywhere, right? And it's a fucking proprietary shell casing. These things are like 60, 70 cents a piece.
That's a good point.
Right? Like, it's very recognizable. This is not a 9mm Parabellum that like every, you know, like gangbanger is going to have like in his pocket or whatever, right? Like by the way, in the parlance of like Craig Zahler.
Yeah.
This is very, very fucking recognizable. There's only one guy with one of these, you know, in a state, right? Anyway.
So it's a weird gun to have in the film, I'm guessing.
It's very fucking weird, right?
So there are three things going on at once here.
For a guy that's stealing petty cash from a liquor store, it's crazy.
He's stealing a lot of cash, and we see him steal more cash down the line where there's two characters. Oddly, there's a handful of characters that get no backstory, the convenience store owner being one of them, and then two others that are walking to their car. They get in, and the gimp bandit is in the back seat. And he like gets up and he just like puts guns to their head and says, empty your pockets, put it in the duffel bag. They empty their pockets. He then kills them, one of them being Hispanic. And the Gimp Bandit puts a sombrero on him, on his dead body, and leaves.
It's unclear if he had the sombrero or the sombrero was in the car already.
It's a baffling scene.
It is baffling.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
So then the bandits take all this money and they bring it to somebody that is Arab coded, at which point, because we're just seeing these bandits are super racist. And it would, yeah, Nate.
It is somebody who is selling them a van from Bulwark Security, which earlier in the film, Mel Gibson's wife had talked about, maybe I'll reach out to our contacts at Bulwark Security for extra work, which makes me wonder, is Bulwark Security just like,
are
those just where cops go when they want to do crime? Like, right. is that like the thing? Is this a thing where like Mel Gibson has been, you get the sense that he has dipped into crime a couple of times, right? He's got the contact Udo Kier at the mall, I guess. Like, there's like a, you know, when you go to a
suit store.
Yeah, when you go to the suit store. There's like a, every suit
maybe
store.
An Eastern European, yeah. Or like you know, he's like Stan Country coded, right? Like
yes,
like ex USSR, but like not Russian, right? Like not Slavic.
In the fascist worldview, every male, like every mall suit store, if you go into the back, there is a very nice secret room where the boss of the store lives. Right there. Right?
Smokes cigars and like does that, mafia
that's
shit.
That's my experience. Every time I go to Men's Warehouse, I'm like, show me that guy that says he likes the way I'm going to look.
You're going look to like the way you look.
Yeah. But so Mel Gibson goes to him and is like, I just need a lead, basically. Yeah. Which I think actually I like the tactic of, I really think Zoller's a really strong writer. Absent the plot hole that you just pointed out, I am convinced that he fucked up on the gun thing. I think that the idea here being that they're going to rob a drug dealer. And I thought for most of the movie, oh, they're going to rob a drug dealer. And it turning into, no, they're going to have to rob a violent bank robber, mm-hmm. being the switch there. This is where the film starts to roll into its momentum. This is where the film starts to turn into Heat. By the end of the movie, it's like Heat, yeah. right? Like,
and I should say, like, Zoller is really good in his other movies too at like obscuring what the plot is going to be, right? Like, some stuff is very expected if you've seen other Zoller films, right? Like character appears and you're like, well, that guy's going to get shot, right?
Yeah,
like, that's pretty like telegraphed. But what ends up being the plot is actually pretty surprising, and it's not. It's not obvious, right? In like, Connor and I have watched some pretty weak films, right? Where you can, within like the first 20 minutes, you like kind of know what's going to happen. Not true of Zoller.
Yes.
Right? I was surprised.
So this is about, we see these three plot lines kind of converging. So Mel Gibson gets this lead and he loops Vince Vaughn into, we're going to stake out this apartment that may or may not have drug money in it. Then we see there are the... oh my God, Henry Johns and his cousin named Biscuit, that is his name, Biscuit, they go to the apartment, and then we see what ends up being these like Gimp bandits come out of the apartment with them. So Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn follow them, and then that is where all three plot lines converge into the crime of the film, which is a bank robbery. Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn follow them after the bank robbery, which we've discussed earlier, where what's her name? Sarah Carpenter, where she just gets her hands. Jennifer Carpenter, where she gets her hands just like shredded and holds up a baby sock and goes, can you give this to my baby boy? And before she's like obliterated.
She looks like she got her hands like a wood chipper. It's fucking
is
crazy.
Is that realistic to those guns, what they would do?
I mean, no, if you get shot, if your fingers get shot with guns, your fingers will come apart. But again, right, like I have to underline, this is just a Zoller thing. He's like a body horror guy. Bone Tomahawk does this a lot. He knows that like shit that happens to your hands is actually very scary and disconcerting, right? Like getting your fingers all fucked up is like horrifying.
Yeah.
And he uses it in his films like over and over and over again, right? I think it's mostly to shock the audience, which apparently if you've read some of the reviews of Ragged Across Concrete, it definitely shocked them. People were like, holy fuck, that lady.
I went into this movie thinking I was going to see gratuitous violence and that it was going to shock me. And somehow that still blew me away. Well, because I think the thing where it's like she'd had a great monologue, like I understand like the little bit of the formulation of like these characters exist to be killed. But I kind of say in some ways, I don't think they like that feels like a woman that is having her own separate journey and then the movie swerves into it. And I think that's a little bit different than just having a girl get shot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe so.
When they introduce her, the setup, the amount of setup they put into her, and also like her level of fame within like Hollywood.
Yeah, she's Dexter's sister, if you... Yeah.
So I see her, and I see her backstory. I'm like, she's going to become a hostage after this bank robbery and will be a part of this movie until it ends. And instead, they just kill her. And this is probably Zoller's attempt to say, like, hey, these victims and all these violent... like, even though we glorify violence in Hollywood, keep in mind, like, these people are victims with their own lives and their own backstories. And, like, when these crimes happen, it is these backstories, these white women backstories that are so sad, aren't they? Isn't it so sad when a white woman dies? And then a hostage is taken, and she's just like nothing. She's nobody. Her name is never, her last name is said, I think, in terms of like a police
because
report.
she does not matter at that point, right? Like where it's like she's just hostage. She's just lady. Like that,
right?
And they're gonna kill her, right? Like, there's no,
yeah,
very clearly, right? You're not confused at all about what's gonna happen to her.
Yeah,
right? You're like, oh, I saw that other lady get fucking plugged.
Yeah,
like this, she's not long. This
is not the case of like Rebecca Hall in The Town, where they take a hostage to ensure safe passage, or whatever, and then they'll let the hostage go on the beach blindfolded or whatever. These guys don't leave loose ends.
No, this hostage is pretty much like a contingency for what if we need to force someone to help us along, like, which is pretty much what happened.
Then they end up pulling that cord.
I was just going to say, like, I forgot one of the funniest things that happens in the film is when they buy the armored car from like the Arab coated suit guy. One, he like shoots at the car, which is crazy. And then two, he throws in the duffel bag with all the money that he's been stealing from people he's murdered around town.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't hand them like...
As if these people don't have like disposable income just lying around. It's very, very insane.
Well, to me, that feels like they were like, hey, Grey Gloves, get us a car. And that's his... And he's just like someone that like people are his ATM.
What's my budget? And he's like, I don't know. Spend 3 days murdering people and go get some money.
Whatever you can pick up, man. Why are you even asking me this question? You got your very rare gun to go.
Yeah. Whatever you do, establish yourself as the most evil person in this film. Like, you got it, Chief.
Exactly.
So the crime happens, at which case the bank robbers take off. But in this moment, it is revealed that Henry Johns and Biscuit they put on makeup to look like white people.
Which is so funny. It's so funny. It's normally the other guys are white guys who have put black over their faces, and the black guys have to like put the white on their face.
So I guess if the cops asked like who was it, like it was five whites. Can you believe it?
Well, I think
we just have to skip over the tape recorder thing and the bank robbery. Also very funny. Doesn't make any sense. But like,
I think the thing though is it's the same thing with like Vince Vaughn doing the thing with his hair. Is like you just need to fuck up the description just enough that you don't meet it. Right.
Yeah. Vince Vaughn doing the thing with his hair. Never seen on camera. You never see his hair with the little you see the process of him spray painting his hair. So it's a disguise. But he's not even allowed out of the car to do like a walk by. And then it disappears. It's like not in his hair.
I've seen this movie 3 times. I literally forgot again after watching it, Connor, that happened in the movie. You guys just reminded
there's
me.
There's a lot of superfluous. This movie could be a tight hour 45. And instead, there's a bunch of superfluous crap that does not matter. A lot of the details do matter, but the scene where like Vince Vaughn's eating a sandwich and it's just like so painfully long
honestly,
of Mel Gibson talking about it.
There's too much Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn is one miscast in this part. This would have been genuinely, if we're going to do a crypto conservative, the way to go at this point is Chris Pratt should have played that part.
that would be
but
sick.
The... he is pretty good at, like, Vince Vaughn's a good actor and everything, but that character doesn't really drive the plot. It's just like, you might as well just have had him be like, I felt nothing about like the proposal and the girlfriend thing.
Well, that's the other thing is like, I've seen so many of these kinds of movies that the moment he's like, I'm going to propose to my girlfriend, like, he's going to fucking die. This is how this is going to wrap up.
So the bank robbery scene is going on, and Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn are tailing them, right? So they see it going down. They're confused about what's happening, right? They're tailing this truck because it came out of the basement that they were tailing the super bad guys drove into there, or that they followed them from their apartment. So now we're tailing them leaving the bank robbery, right? And they see, right through the door, a bunch of bodies, and they're like, we're not even supposed to be doing this, and our goal is to just rob these guys. So they don't even call the cops. They just keep rolling following this armored car.
Right. Yeah.
So they follow this armored car all the way up to the point where they come to some kind of junkyard. And that is where the movie really oddly ramps up for me, because it has now become a standoff. It is a standoff between Biscuit, Henry Johns, and the Gimp Bandits. It is a standoff between Mel Gibson, Vince Vaughn, and
those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's just like mini standoffs within the parties. It's so tense. It's so fun. That is where, like, y'all said Heat. When I was watching this, I was like, everybody wants to remake Heat. Like, I would not quite say that it's Heat, because I think Heat is like untouchable, and there's like more tension and cat and mouse and more stakes. This, like, you know, crippled wife and unnamed daughter that's bullied, like, I just didn't think a lot of this had to, like, Val Kilmer would be the Vince Vaughn character if we made the comparison, and Val Kilmer would die. However, Val Kilmer gets away. Sorry, Heat spoilers.
Yeah, you're spoiling Heat. I will say this exists comfortably in the zone between Heat and Den of Thieves, where Den of Thieves is a well-made dumb guy making his Heat. This is, I think, this is a movie that is using aspects of Heat. I think also, I see a lot of Assault on Precinct 13, the Carpenter movie in this. Obviously, so Don Siegel and Sam Peckinpah are just like all over everything, as I understand it, Zoller, where the idea of these directors that are able to, one, use violence to shock and unsettle the audience, and then two, somehow create enough tension towards the end of the movie where not... Like, the Wikipedia entry of the last hour of the movie is probably a couple of paragraphs, right? Like, it has to be. It's not complex.
And this is, like, the success of Zoller, right? Because, like, so I think some things are formulaic, but that's from Zoller, right? Like, when they introduce somebody and you're like, that guy's going to get shot. But everything else about his, like, setup, and it's taken, right, Connor, what, like, an hour and 10 minutes to get here, is some of it is so bizarre that you really have no idea what the fuck is going to happen once we reach this, like, the violent zenith of his films. All of them are like this. That's why they're so fucking entertaining, right? The suspense is real because you have no idea where this is going, right? You didn't even know that it was going to be a bank robbery.
Yeah. And the standoff scene, I should say the standoff scene happens in real time. Like, there's no time skips. There's no, like, jumping around. Like, everything else up to this point is, like, hopping around in time. But the moment they get to the dump, it is real time. And we are with them for every second. And that's, like, an hour-long standoff. Glossing over this real quick, like, pretty much everybody dies except for Henry Johns and Mel Gibson. There is a moment where Vince Vaughn pulls out a sniper rifle that has absolutely nothing to do with the plot at all. Not a single bullet lands. It does nothing. It adds nothing to the film other than
it doesn't shoot anyone, right?
Connor, you're incorrect about this.
What does it add to the film?
It keeps them in the van. Like, a part of doing that is
suppressing fire.
It's suppressing fire. You're right. It's what gives them the initiative.
You are correct.
So in that scene, like, I think the car, the gimp cops, right? The gimp robbers like open the window and just like spray like Mel Gibson's shitty old car with like automatic like fire, right? So, and like one of the things that happens is like, I guess the gas tank gets pierced. So like Vince Vaughn for like the next hour is like laying in like a pool of gasoline.
Yeah, he's laying in a pool of gasoline.
It's so funny. And they keep having to like refill the car because
he's like, you're leaking.
It's like, it's very funny and very stupid.
Yeah.
Right?
So at the end of the standoff, there are only two men standing, Mel Gibson and Henry Johns. And at that point, they just like, they have a scuffle before they realize, all right, we can both get rich. We'll split it 60-40. Let's get rid of the evidence here. Let's get rid of the bodies. And Henry Johns at that point reveals, like, hey, I've got dirt on you because basically the hostage that the bandit Gimps took. They used her as bait to try and kill Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn. She kills Vince Vaughn, but Mel Gibson shoots her, and that's caught on tape. So Henry John says, like, I've got this.
Strangely, in literal self-defense, right? Literally, yes. He shoots her in self-defense, and he's like, you're going to go to prison for this. And it's like, it's probably the one thing that he does that isn't, right? Like
well, but he's prison time, but he's forever. There. Right, like it's like one of the things where it's
exactly,
like
exactly, yeah. Right, yeah.
So Mel Gibson puts a gun to Henry Johns' head and says, "Look, I'm going to let you take your 60% of the gold bullion that we have, but I need that cell phone video." They scuffle. Henry Johns shoots Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson dies, and we cut to Henry Johns now lives in a mansion. His mom is off heroin and no longer a prostitute. It's getting a massage. And a twist of events where I expected his little brother to be in his little brother basically now has every video game ever. I thought it would have been more fitting if instead of a video game, he had like a physical therapist and was walking again. I don't know. Maybe that's too saccharine for this film. And then we see Mel Gibson's crippled wife is just like so scared of the blacks in her neighborhood, and she receives a package full of gold bullion, and the final line of the film is thank you, and then it cuts to credits.
Yep.
And a very jarring credit sequence. It's like music concrete. That doesn't really match the film, but
odd font too, I thought.
Very odd font.
You know, Craig, if you're taking notes, although, you know,
this is a calling card. He loves to abruptly end his movies, and he's just like, movie's over, get out.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Abruptly after 2 hours and 40 minutes of like,
yeah,
exactly.
There was a credit, there was a quote that I saw that was just like, with people reviewing the movie. On this, so critics, it does seem like generally kind of like the movie, right? Like I think most film people, regardless of their politics, kind of respect Zoller, at least to like some degree. I thought this was a good description of it. This is a long film, but there's something so horribly compelling about its unhurried slouch towards the precipice. That's Peter Bradshaw at The Guardian. And I was like, unhurried slouch towards the precipice is the way this film feels, because it's about old men. Is this propaganda? Propagandos?
Of a kind. Like, I would say that, like, if you like Michael Mann, and I like Michael Mann,
yeah,
then I think you, like, have to like Zoller, right? Like, there's not as much, like, Michael Mann's films, like, I think are elevated because so much of them happen in that, like, golden cool era of the like 80s to the 90s, right? And he like maintains that feel, that vibe, right? But the substance of his films and the characters they're in, and like literally some of the structures of it, are very, very much in like the mold of Michael Mann, or again, right, the politics of Sam Peckinpah, but the filmography, right? Like the construction of these other, I think, great filmmakers. Now, Michael Mann is also, right, like, a bit of a propagandist. He has, like, a bent. He has, like, a kind of character and a kind of world that all of his films inhabit, and this very much does, too. And I think that makes it propaganda.
Yeah, Mann's definitely a, like, these men just need these women to get out of their way. Like, women are the obstacle in, like, every Michael Mann. Love.
Strong men making their mark.
Yeah, and the women who love them.
I think the crucial thing about Michael Mann's like films that make them less like overtly offensive is that Zoller's films are always about a fallen world, a decaying and by the way, very degenerate world that these men, right, these strong men who are imparting themselves, there's like an era, there's an aura of like goodness, even if it's like partially corrupted, right, like Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn in this. There's an aura, there's like a kernel of goodness about like these powerful men that are trying to respond to or live or self-actualize within this fallen world that like Michael Mann's film just don't have, right? Like, in Thief, right, like, we're stealing from some nameless, faceless corporation that we don't like anyway, right? Like, fuck them. Who cares? Like, steal the money. It's cool, right? It's fucking awesome. Steal all the money. He doesn't, like, have to pretend that there's some, like, goodness behind stealing the money. It's just fucking cool.
Well, I was going to say, I think that the Michael Mann of it also is that there is this equivalence between cops and robbers where it's, like, game... Yeah. recognized game, right? Like, we're like, I think Michael Mann really likes cops. Like, I think he finds them very interesting. Obviously, he got one of them, Detective Dennis Farina, into a, like, a massive acting career. But the, but also, I think he, like, is really interested by, like, by criminals. Like, I think he thinks that's a cool deal as well. There's somebody made a joke once about how he litters his films with so many like people who are actually cops and actually criminals that it's almost as if like, is this just how he gets out of jams? Is he offers people parts in his films?
That's so funny. That's really good. That's why he wrote Heat 2.
Yeah, Heat 2. I need to read that.
I have it sitting on my shelf. Maybe that'll be our first book club episode.
Book club. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I love Zoller. Like, I think for the people who love his movies, like, regardless of whether they agree with the politics, and there are some people online that are like, these movies, like, I'm right wing and I like Zoller's films because I agree with like the political motivation. Regardless of if you do that, you know, I think they're good art. And the fact that some people do agree with the politics means that I think that is like by definition makes them like propaganda. Right?
Yeah.
They're saying something and some people are picking it up and nodding their heads, right? And going like, yes, correct.
Yeah. Is there anybody that is the Zoller of the left? Like, I mean of the actual left. I don't mean like, because any like conservative that's listening to that would be like all of them. They're all lefties. But I think, I mean, like in the true, like I am a communist or I'm a crypto, like, or an anarchist.
If you truly would, like, why would you participate within like this Hollywood system? So, like,
so you can make your cool movie.
Right? Yeah, but like, even it absolutely like undermined any leftist bona fides you might proclaim to have. If anything,
that's a problem with leftist politics, that people care about their bona fides and not making a great film to propagandize. Because like honestly, you see this movie and you leave it like maybe like 2% more conservative. You know, like
I would actually say that like somebody like Nicholas Winding Refn would be like that, right? Like if you've seen Pusher, I think they're extremely critical of like systemic violence and like cops and like that kind of enforcement.
Well, have y'all seen, right? Like, Alec? I know you haven't, but Nate, have you seen How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
No, I have not.
So that is like, it's directed by a guy named Daniel Goldhaber, who only had like one movie before that. How to Blow Up a Pipeline is a very leftist movie. It tries to reach a like kind of class consciousness that like, you know, crosses the political spectrum about like what oil and gas companies do. Like there's a conservative coded Christian guy who's just like, eminent domain is ruining my life to build a pipeline. And so that's what like brings them into this fold of like leftist revolutionary radicals. And the way the movie ends, it is not a critique of violence against against oil and gas companies. It's an okay movie. You know, the soundtrack is incredible. We might talk about it on this podcast one day. But there is a scene where like all the characters are talking to each other and it's just like the most ham-fisted Socratic dialogue of like, but wait, was not Jesus a terrorist? Like,
okay, dude. Everybody's been in that meeting where you're just like,
yeah, like, can we just like move the fuck on, please? It's like it's interesting.
The dual imperatives of leftist art, that it, one, be entirely morally coherent and perfect, and two, not have an ounce of cringe. Yeah. Like where it's like,
Boots Riley. Occurred to me. Boots Riley is that left leaning person. I mean, Sorry to Bother You is an incredible film. So I think he is the only person that could be that like left version of Zoller. There's no violence though.
If you're going back, I mean, it's Paul Verhoeven, right? But like I kind of want to do it. I kind of want to have like somebody who's even partially modern.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a thing. The film is such an interesting way to propagandize, like, especially if you look in, especially how much, like, the Lost Cause myth in itself received so much help from the film industry in Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind, Gods and Generals, you know, like all the way, good Cold Mountain, all the way going up.
Boo, Gods and Generals. God, Jesus Christ.
It's bad.
What a terrible film.
The big takeaway on this, Mel Gibson needs to return to the stage and he needs to play King Lear. I think it's time. And I think he is the most that anyone has ever needed to play that part, because it's like, let's see these 65 years, these 70 years of sin and power and everything weighing down on you and being brought low. And Mel Gibson is a fantastic Shakespearean actor when he dips into that.
I've never seen him do something as like that since...
The Hamlet in 1990 is...
Braveheart, probably.
Yeah, his... Zoller really likes to pull people out of Shakespeare. A lot of his... He says that a lot of his people that he casts are people he's seen on stage. And Tori Kittles was doing something Shakespeare on stage when he got this part, when he was approached with this part. Partially because it is so, like, the dialogue is loquacious to the point where it can sound pretty bad if it doesn't have... I don't think any of Mel Gibson's lines in this movie ring false to me. Like, I think he has a pretty good... Even, like, I know Connor said one thing... People that aren't going to watch this movie, Mel Gibson's character has a tick where he analyzes everything by the percentage that it is likely to happen.
So annoying.
I like that. And I think that there is an example there of that's kind of the way you have to view the Zoller things, is like on those sort of gradients.
Can I read the message that Connor sent to the group chat?
Please, so, go ahead.
So Connor's like, because it's so funny. So Connor's first message yesterday, what the fuck is this movie? This is offending my leftist sensibilities. I think there's a little bit of irony there.
Yeah, I was just I was being cheeky.
Where are you at? Blah, blah, blah. So Connor, this movie sucks shit. Can't wait to discuss. And then there's this change comes over him. He's like, just finished. It ramped the fuck up very quickly. Love the standoff at that weird dump or whatever. Next message. My main issue was the dialogue. Like, for the first hour, Vince Vaughn says, quote, anchovies every 5 minutes. Wait, by the way, which I think is like, he's like, this is fishy. Right?
That's his way of being like, that's his, instead of saying like, ah, crap.
He just says, he says anchovies. That's very pulpy to me. That's like detectives always have their like,
it's like a literal comic book or something, right? Like
yeah.
Every 5 minutes, and then he stops saying it. Yeah, because he doesn't say it after that. The Mel Gibson percentages thing got annoying, and it felt like more and more like I was watching one of those dime a dozen quirky cop shows where a cop is autistic and has to speak in terms of percentages, which is so funny.
That's how it felt. And it's like, where did this come from? Because as soon as anchovy started to taper off, that's when the percentages started to pick up.
Yeah, and then I was to do a different quirky thing in his writing.
And then I started to do some work for Zoller, and I was like, I guess this paid off by the end, being like, how about 60-40?
It's
like,
it's okay. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
The numbers.
It felt like he worked backwards from like that bit, like all the way through the movie.
I will say, I think Mel Gibson is the least autistic performer. I can't imagine him playing an autistic cop.
Yeah, by the way, like, regardless of whether you enjoyed like the film, like, as like, if will you watch this again? I've seen it multiple times.
I will watch
it. I probably will. I probably will continue to watch like Zoller.
Oh, I'll probably show this to people. Like, I'll probably be like, hey, come over, let's watch this. Like, it was enough. It has entered into the, like, to me, it enters into a pantheon of films that includes Heat, not to say it's on the same level as Heat, where it's like, well, you just kind of got to see this, right? Like, you just, like, it's an experience to go through that pot boil, you know, and see everything.
It might change now that I have, like, a kid running around the house, because, like, this is, like, when it's violent, it's, like, ultra violence. It's crazy, right? Like, the lady, like, getting her, like, fingers all, like, shot to pieces. It's wild.
Yeah.
Zoller's, like, violence. But this is, like, very much, like, a dumb movie to put on that, like, my version of that. Right. Instead of like, you know, some like rom-com or something, this is what I would like. Right. Where like I'm washing dishes and then I go and I'm looking at like Mel Gibson's like 30-70 and I'm just like, oh,
yes.
Like this movie sucks. Right? Like, I love it. So outside of that, did you guys like the actual performances?
Yeah. All right. So Mel Gibson. Yes. I mean, like, just genuinely, I think I'm very in the tank for him as an actor. I think he's got one. He's one of the rare people who can do Nicolas Cage, Al Pacino big, but almost never brings it out. which I think is the sign of a good actor. Vince Vaughn, I said earlier, I think is miscast. Tori Kittles is great as Henry Johns in this. I think that is not an easy part, especially because he is asked to carry like the first 10 minutes of the movie, where like he's not on the poster, he's not, but like you're seeing his journey. And I was interested on like, who is this guy?
He ends up being the most fleshed out, the most sympathetic,
yes,
the most like normal, the most relatable, the most, and like probably the, and I assume that the film is doing this on purpose. It has to be, right? Like the most laudable, right, character in their actions. He ends up being basically the only honorable man in the film.
Right? The only person he kills is Mel Gibson, right?
And when he says, right, like, why did you do this? My word was like my word, right? I would have stood on it. I think so too.
I think that one of the things that's so beautiful about that standoff between those two characters when they engage in it is that you as the audience know that they can trust each other, like they, but they don't know that, and they can't know that, right? Like and like that is that's what is the, like, the Greek tragedy of it. It's like
it feels right.
Yeah,
Connor, did you like the film and like the dialogue specifically, like? Will it arrest you from like watching his other films?
No, I'm gonna watch Bone Tomahawk. I'm gonna watch his other stuff. I've heard nothing but good things about Bone Tomahawk. And when you pitched this to me originally, it was not a like, this is a good movie. Like, you're like, dude, it's so bad. I was like, okay, I'm gonna check it out. I will say the dialogue was not my favorite. A lot of I don't think Zoller like really knows a lot of black people. I'll just say that
there's a lot of N-words.
Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, and that part at the end where they're in the standoff and Tori Kittles says N-word and Mel Gibson says likewise.
Yeah. So, in terms of the performances, Nate, to what you said about Vince Vaughn being miscast, I 100% agree. I felt like he and Mel Gibson did not have the chemistry that was required for this to be like an endearing kind of buddy cop-ish kind of thing. I like Don Johnson. I always love Don Johnson, whatever he does. You don't bring Don Johnson out for 5 minutes. That was a big critique of mine. Like, he never showed back up again. I was very disappointed in that. One thing, this is not about the performance, but one thing that I found very interesting about Vince Vaughn's character is when, you know, he's saying racist stuff as well, and it is revealed that his girlfriend is of color. And that made me wonder, like, so is he trying to impress Mel Gibson, or is this just like a coincidence? Like, is he like putting on racist airs for his partner?
I think you would be very surprised the latitude that white men who date black or white men who date black women feel that they have on those sorts of issues in general. Another example of that happening is like in Pulp Fiction, right? Where like Quentin Tarantino's character uses the N-word a bunch. And then when his wife comes in, she's black. So there's, there is an element there, but yeah.
Do you think that was intentional?
Yeah. Interestingly, there was like an interview. I was watching an interview with Zoller and Tori Kittles that they were giving together. I think they did a lot of press together. He was talking about how this grew out of something he was writing for HBO that they passed on when they made True Detective, that they were like, this is too duplicative. Which Tori Kittles, who was in True Detective, was like, well, right. But he was like, yeah, I was going to do it. There wasn't going to be a single white character in there. Like, or he said something like that. Like, I think he might not know. I don't know how well he knows black people or whatever, but I think he is very interested in like putting black people on film, you know, and putting non-white people on film.
Do you think it's like Tarantino? Like, cause I think Tarantino definitely has a black fetishization element to a lot of his work.
Well, Tarantino, that's his collective stepfathers, right? Like where it was kind of like has a lot of like black father figures in his life. I don't know enough about Zoller, you know, like I know he's from Miami. He's right. Jewish, but an atheist. He has a terrible haircut that is a ponytail that is pulled very tight.
And his sorry, hair is thinning. Ladies, but he refuses to get married.
He refuses to get married.
Yeah.
Despite
I think he literally is like he saw an interview with Michael Mann when he was young, and he's like, I'm going to do that. This is awesome.
Yeah.
Right. And like, he's lived his entire life basically to do like that. Right. Like while I was listening to you guys talk about like the characters and the dialogue, Connor, he does that thing that Michael Mann loves to do where like, you've got like your cop character or whatever, and they're like bitching about how much money they make. And then they go to their apartment and it's like fabulous.
Yes.
You're like, They live in like a $2 million like apartment, like a condo, right, on a Miami beach. And like in a Michael Mann film, you just have to like go with it because he just likes those cool locations. And he's like, fuck it, who cares? Like his apartment's going to be cool because it's a cool location to shoot in, whatever, right? Like, and
also,
and Zoller does the same thing in this film.
Cops make a lot of money. Like, cops make, like,
not that much.
The overtime, have you seen how much overtime?
Vaughn.
Like,
yeah, but like Vince Vaughn goes back to like his like the excuse, right, is that like the girlfriend, right, is like a hotshot lawyer or something, right? But like, he goes back to his apartment. It's his apartment. And it's like, you know, 20 stories up, like overlooking like the city skyline. It's like minimalist with like modern furniture, right? It's really, it's great. He drives like a nice, you know, a very very nice like Cadillac sedan, right? It just like reminds me so much of like
it's like they treat like cars and buildings and sets the way that Jerry Bruckheimer treats women, where it's like every single one of these has to be like beautiful.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think it's one of those like beauty is a virtue kind of things. But that's like really psychoanalyzing. Okay. Connor, do we have any like final thoughts? I think we've like
My final thought, I didn't get a chance to respond to Nate's question about like, is it propaganda? The most propagandistic element of this film is the like, cops don't get paid enough and this world is changing, which this would not have been allowed to come out after 2020. Like, and this whole like, you can't make this today, like, yeah, I think a lot of this shit would get cut or like nobody would touch the script. You know, it's propaganda in that it's like, it's suggesting that like, cops don't get paid enough, cops can't do their fucking jobs because the world is too woke now. There is no pushback or punishment on Vince Vaughn and Mel Gibson complaining about like wokeness. There's scenes where they're like, they're in a diner and they hear a song that's like, is a woman singing this or is a man singing this? And Vince Vaughn's like, dude, that line is like dissolved. Like, who cares? Like, so yeah, you funny. Can't even tell the difference no more because men say we're pregnant.
I was so relieved that that did not turn into an anti-trans like rant. Like on that, I was oh, thanks, Craig.
Yeah, it was still 2018, so it wasn't. Yeah, that wasn't in the zeitgeist yet.
He was still just on like men are pussies.
Yeah,
like, yeah,
okay. Yeah. It's like it's very right wing in the way that I think it projects these like. These like societal, you know, I mean, classic, right? Like these political and economic failures onto some kind of cultural thing, right? It's just like, we're letting them wear dresses now, y'all. And this is like why cops don't get paid enough. And it's like, what are we talking about? You know, you fucking moron.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you hit the nail on the head there. So I mean, if propaganda, as we've defined it before, just like reasserts what you already believe. Yeah, this is propaganda for a certain amount of people. But yeah, it's not going to inspire anyone to get up off their couch and do anything. If anything, it will inspire you to be more like Mel Gibson's wife and lock the door and be like, there's blacks. Oh, no.
Take OxyContin and hang out in your apartment.
Well, yes. I think this actually is a good I was going to bring this up earlier, but I think with the whole like abolish the police, one of the good arguments against it is like, well, if you abolish the police, they're just going to do what Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn did in this movie. Like, these are actually like people that you have to like if
you have an enormous force of highly trained, adept criminals.
Yeah, it does raise a salient point about like corruption comes from people at least feeling as if they are being underpaid.
Yeah, yeah, and undermined.
Nate, like, you're talking about it like it's like disbanding the Iraqi army in like 2004.
That's exactly what it would be. That's exactly what it would be. Yeah. Like, that's why, like, I'm always like, I think, like, you know, not to go like too lefty, like, I am pro, like, police abolition, especially as like a North Star. But the idea that like one day, like, we're going to elect, you know, like a Brandon Johnson mayor, and he's going to be like, and there are no more police. And it's like, okay, well, let me introduce you to, you know, the new world order that is these guys just robbing banks and shit. Like,
if only there were some kind of force to stop them.
Yeah, yeah, that's the.
I will say, like, I had a fascist moment yesterday. Like, so if it's Friday, we're taking the boy to like the mall, right? Like, that's like our idea of fun, right? We take the stroller to the mall, we do a couple circuits around the mall, and then we go to the food court and have like a sandwich or whatever. And like, at the other side of the Friday food court, which is like not full, right? Somebody got in an altercation with the guy that works at the like Chinese buffet, right? And there was the cop, a hilarious cop, right? Like a dude who works out a lot, huge, uniform way too tight, way too much shit on his vest, right? He looks like he's a medic going into Fallujah with all the shit that's like on his vest. And he went over and probably had the kind of conversation, right? I didn't overhear, but like, is there a problem here? Like, are you beginning to fight at the fucking mall? And they had a little back and forth, and like everything was fine, right? And I thought, like, you know what? Even as a lefty that like rags on the cops all the time, if I was American Stalin, we would have guys like that who their job is to hang out and then be like, sir, please, can we not, like, this is a nice space.
Yeah.
Like, whatever argument you're having with the Chinese buffet man, right? Like, please don't, like, freak the fuck out in public.
Don't ruin everybody else's day.
Exactly, right? Like, people are here with their children.
We live in a society.
Whatever you're doing, it's not worth it. And yeah, and now I'm S. Craig Zahler, and, you know, I think I think Mel Gibson should run the NYPD.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? That's, he certainly has proved, I think, between this and Lethal Weapon, that he knows how to like talk like a cop and banter. So,
and knowing is half the battle.
Yeah, and what else is he going to do?
All right, seat of vacantist Catholics in the mold of Mel Gibson, like myself, of course. Nate, I assume you'll be converting to the Church of the Holy See soon, so that we can take it over and throw out this horrible Argentinian that's found himself there. We're cutting that.
Down with the Franciscan.
Yeah, and in all honesty, Nate, I have given some serious thought to like bringing you back for when Passion of the Christ Resurrection comes out, because I am very excited for the sequel to Passion of the Christ.
Do you know who wrote the script for Passion of Christ?
The original guy.
It's Randall Wallace who wrote Braveheart. Like, yeah. They're reuniting. Wow. Yeah. I listened to Randall Wallace on Jordan Peterson's podcast.
What did he have to say?
Well, so it was interesting because I was like, I was doing the thing on Braveheart. I was doing a deep dive on Braveheart and trying to find stuff. It's just like, Randall Wallace is just like a super like normie Christian dude. Like, he's just like one of those, like, there's, you know, like good guys and there's bad guys. And we just got to, you know, like, he like has incredibly uncomplicated, mildly conservative politics. So I didn't get like, cause I was like trying to like, but he does. There's one part where that's kind of interesting where he talks about how he has this friend, very close friend, who's Catholic, who doesn't take communion cause he's not in a state of grace. And is that you too on the
I am not baptized and I'm not really a part of the church, so I do not
take what
communion. Actually, my wife doesn't take communion because we're not married in the church. She's fucking serious. She does not
then
take
why communion. The fuck do you go to Episcopal church?
Because she wants to bring the kid up.
Then go to the Episcopal church. You can still get your cracker and grape juice.
I am not going to an Episcopal church, Connor. A king made that up, Connor, and not a French one. Okay, so no. I am going to be in a church with the good food people, the Mexicans, the Spanish, the Italians. Miss me with that British shit. I'm not fucking.
Then go
doing
to the
it.
Catholic Those Charismatic Center, man. That's where they're all going anyway.
In like 10 years, I just have like a white guy with like a taco truck with like a giant like Maria of Guadalupe painted on it. That'd be sick. So wait, so Nate, I presume you're going to go see Passion of the Christ.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. I'm going to hate it. I did not. I despise Passion of the Christ.
Wow, I loved it.
We have got to do an episode.
Because I don't,
Connor, yeah. You are going to see it?
Yeah, of course I'm going to go see it. I love Passion of the Christ 1.
Yeah. Are they even making it yet?
They as of September of 2024, they have been location scouting. So it's coming.
Okay.
And there are two versions of the script that they're trying to like synthesize into one. Because one is like very literal and one is like super like Mel Gibson has described it like an acid trip. And I'm like, that, do that. I want to see.
That sounds sick.
Like I really love Aronofsky's Noah specifically for the like trippy, like when you get a vision from God scene. And the rock golems awesome. That are like, we're here to help, Noah.
My parents hated that movie as just like normal Mormons were completely baffled.
They were probably like, what the fuck?
They were absolutely baffled by it.
Okay, you guys want to call it on yep. this? This is
dude, yeah. It's always,
I like this.
Always a pleasure.
Always,
this.
Always fun to see.
Again, I want to be clear. I love this movie. Go watch it. I like Zoller's films.
Yeah. So as always, send us an email, propagandospod@gmail.com. Join our Discord, which you can find in the show notes. Hit us up on social media. We're on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter, all at propagandospod. Maybe we'll hop on the Truth Social. I'm not sure. Why not? Why the fuck not? I'm on Truth. Oh, Excelsior Propagandos, and as always, keep your eyes on the skies.
Anchovies.